The things that fascinate me about real-world science are very the midway between application-based science and, you know, esoteric thinking about possibilities and, you know, asking questions just because you can ask them. It's a blend between that, which is also, I think, what the surviving sky is very much like there. I went about saying, what are some questions about this world that I'm curious about that intrigue me? And what are these extremely smart, brilliant people? Like, what are they going to be thinking? The questions that they're going to be answering or asking and exploring. So it was that pursuit of questions and knowledge, really, in many ways, that defined a lot of these characters. Ahilya is an archaeologist. You know, she's looking for a way to survive on this murderous planet. Iravan is studying consciousness, you know, himself, which is like one of the best things to study and, you know, defines so many parts of our world, understanding of who we are, you know, cool things like that. The engineer characters are studying, like, you know, how they can make their world function better with the technology that they have and the resources they have. But none of it came from me saying, like, I want to put science into the world. Like, that's not where it came from. It came from, like, what is cool and what is curious. And science is nothing but, you know, a set of replicable, observable behaviors that, you know, make sense and they have logic to them. And, you know, you apply the same pressures and the same result and consequence will happen.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 60 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, my dear MJ Kuhn. How are you, MJ?
Hello, I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing fantastic. And if you'd like to support MJ and her work, you can pick up Among Thieves, her debut novel. If you're a fan of books like Scott Lynch's The Lies of Locke Lamora or Robert Jackson Bennett's Foundry Side, all those kinds of fun heist kinds of stories, this one's for you. It's got some morally gray characters and some pretty fucked up shit, but it's really good, and I think you'll enjoy it. Thick as Thieves, the sequel of this duology, is also out on July 25th, so you can get yourself a pre-order and support what MJ does. As well, a quick note for everyone out there listening or watching. The official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app, and subscribe to the FanFiatic YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, joining us once again is the wonderful Krithika H. Rao, author of The Surviving Sky. Welcome back, Krithika. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
Happy to have you here. And a heads up, this is part two of our two-part chat with Krithika. So I recommend checking out part one to get to know her better. Today, though, we're donning our lab coats as we delve into a mini masterclass on science in fantasy. Just to kick things off, the book industry likes to put books and authors into boxes. Of course, genre and all that shit makes it really easy for them to sell things to booksellers. Yeah. We often think of science fiction and fantasy as mutually exclusive, but of course we know that isn't true. There's a lot of crossover. But for you, Krithika, what was the first science fantasy book, show, or movie that you watched or read and loved? And what was it about it that you loved so much?
So I referred to this actually in the previous episode about how I kind of got into science fiction and fantasy via, you know, the route of thriller. So, I mean, that should tell you something about genres, really, yeah. You know, being this weird, like, thing because the books and the author that got me into science fiction and fantasy way back when, like, I started reading books like that when I was a kid was Michael Crichton, and he is never really, you know, marketed as a science fiction fantasy author. He's always marketed as a thriller author because thriller is this massive, like, piece of the publishing industry, often finds its way into Hollywood. And Michael Crichton was very much a writer who wrote for Hollywood in many ways. You know, his books were very much designed to, you know, become movies, etc. Not that he didn't do his research, and, you know, I certainly enjoyed his books, you know, in many ways more than some of the movies, but specifically for science fantasy, there's this book of his, which is called Timeline. It's not a very good book, but I really loved it. You know, looking back, I'm like, it's not a very well-written book in some ways, but I loved it. Like, I still love it. I'll pick it up and read it. You know, sometimes you get attached.
Read it at your own peril, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, very entertaining. I will give you that. You know, it is extremely entertaining and it has some really cool shit. And he does these fascinating things, I think, with science fiction and fantasy in general. And the premise of Timeline really is that, you know, there's this kind of like a time travel element. These group of scientists get sent back into 1314, you know, the 100-year war between England and France, etc. They get sent back because they have to rescue another scientist who accidentally went back, and they have to bring this scientist back. And it's just a group of these like PhD students and academics who kind of, you know, have no training in, you know, living in medieval England and France and who find themselves, you know, suddenly thrust into this extremely violent world where broadswords and, you know, there's evisceration of women and children and, you know, there's jousting and all of that kind of stuff. But they're academics, right? They're doing their PhD in that. So in the real world, that's... that's really, so they have a lot of like academic background. They're like, yeah, this is what the architecture is and this is what the culture is. And then they go back in time to rescue this, you know, professor, and they're confronted with like, holy shit, is reality ever different from like what we thought it was going to be, right? And obviously because they're modern day scientists, they bring all of that modern day language, etc., to a point where they go back into time and, you know, the English that they're speaking is very different from the English that even Englishmen are speaking during the 100-year war, etc. So the premise of this book is fascinating, and I actually really enjoy this book, and it is written like a thriller. It is very pacing. There's some parts in the beginning of it which are, you know, very you know, kind of a little bit more dense in terms of science, etc., but I love those parts. Like, even those parts, I think Michael Crichton does this amazing job. He did this in Jurassic Park as well, where he writes those parts with so much like passion and so much like, you know, there's so much, the stakes are so fresh, like you really care about this like weird thing that he's talking about. And I shouldn't say the book isn't good, because obviously I think it's actually a really good book. The movie that came out was actually,
I was just gonna say, I was like, yeah. I remember you said Timeline, I'm just like, Paul Walker.
Yes, Paul Walker was in that movie. Yeah, it was like, not a good movie.
No, it was shit, but
it was shit. Yeah. They did such
watch
a bad
your
job.
Own peril.
Yeah, watch it in your own peril. But read the book if you're into that, because the premise, I think, is like fantastic. And I think the book is written extremely well. I actually, you know, wore out my first copy and then I had to get a second one. So nice. Because I read it so many times because of that. And then, of course, Jurassic Park, you know, which was such a defining thing of my childhood, really. So Jurassic Park is very much science fiction, but Timeline for me was, I think, the first. I moved from Jurassic Park via Michael Crichton, just following the author, into Timeline, and that was science fantasy for me, because I loved all the science nerdy bits of, you know, Timeline. But I also loved that, you know, here this group of scientists, they are thrust into, you know, medieval England and France, and like are witnessing these like Game of Thrones-ish sort of politics and sport and, you know, world building and battle and all of that. But they're scientists, and in their scientist brain, they're decoding and, you know, dissecting a lot of these things from their academic brain. So when I was writing Surviving Sky, I did deliberately blend these two genres for myself, because in Surviving Sky, you have engineers who are called sungineers, essentially. So they do a lot of like nerdy engineering talk, etc., but the world is also fantasy, you know, it's very much a fantasy world. So yeah, I mean, genres are things that, especially science fiction and fantasy being this, you know, kind of one or the other, but you look at editors' manuscript wish lists and you look at like acquiring editors, often like very similar editors are acquiring both science fiction and fantasy, you know, and
or
stuff
even
like that.
More than that, I feel like,
or even horror and things like that too, yeah. Right, or even like across genres, like just speculative really. So
yeah, I'm curious. I think it's fascinating though, you're entryway to the genre was really through a genre mashup type story, yeah. Right? If those thriller sci-fi, because I still remember, I can't remember who the guest was, maybe Adrian will, when a guest we had a while ago mentioned that Jurassic Park was sci-fi, and I like had a moment where I was like, holy shit, Jurassic Park is sci-fi. Like, and it's one of those things that doesn't connect because it is so Hollywood. It's so thriller, right? Yeah. So would you say that you kind of have had a very fluid perception of genre from like the very beginning of your like reader and writer career?
Yeah,
yeah, because it kind of plays into what we talked about last episode too, with like your upbringing in India as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So in the last episode, we kind of talked a little bit about how I grew up in India, and in India, science fiction and fantasy is still very much a nascent genre. And when I was growing up and, you know, reading all of that, like, it was very much not really a thing. The closest anything really came to that was magical realism. You had Salman Rushdie's work, etc., and, you know, a lot of other authors like that kind of operating in that space. Magical realism is very much its own thing. But again, I personally, I believe that genres are fluid, mutable, you know, things. Like, they are not like fixed things. So clearly, look at, you know, Michael Crichton, etc. So yeah, my entire entry into science fiction and fantasy was very much fluid right from the beginning. Like, in recent times, especially after, you know, really getting entrenched in science fiction and fantasy world, much of what I read is very much within the genre. I still take the time to read outside of the genre when I can, when I get recommendations that my friends can't stop talking about, right? But before that, it was like, I would read everything. Like, it's only now, because of lack of time, etc., that I, you know, DNF books. But back when I was growing up, like, I would read cover to cover, whether or not I knew what the hell was going on in the book, or, you know, I followed the story if it was too complex for me, etc. I read everything. And in my head, like, all of that, you know, became this thing which, you know, like, Surviving Sky has thriller pacing, and it has characterization, which, you know, in many ways can considered, you know, literary, and it has like a mystery plot, and it has like very hardcore world building, which is akin to Brandon Sanderson's work. And, you know, it takes some experimental leaps, and it's been compared to N.K. Jemisin, which is like amazing to, you know, hear that in reviews, etc. But it's a huge part of it is because I just read whatever came across, you know, my table and my desk and my library, you know, card kind of let me get it, or my mom and dad would like get these books, and I would just be like, cool book, I'm gonna read. You know, I wasn't like, oh, what does a cover look like, what does a jacket copy look like, I'm like, here's a book, I'm gonna read it,
right? Like, it's got pages, there's words on them, good.
Yeah, I'm reading it, you know? So,
yeah, and speaking
of genre, was just this like thing that I didn't think about very much.
Yeah. Which is really cool. Why, speaking of The Surviving Sky, it's like the way that it blends so many genres together seamlessly is fantastic. But for you, why did you decide to include science elements and scientists? Because there are multiple scientist characters. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different forms of scientists. It plays into the society and all these different kinds of things. But also at the same time, like, how does science play into your real life in terms of like what you read up on, or like the things that fascinate you about real world science?
I think the things that fascinate me about real world science are very, they're midway between application based science and, you know, esoteric thinking about possibilities and, you know, asking questions just because you can ask them. It's a blend between that, which is also, I think, what The Surviving Sky is very much like. They are clearly faced with this, you know, application-based thing of how the hell do we survive on a planet that's trying to kill us, right? And it has an impact on their lives and the decisions they make for their society and their relationships and everything, really. But then it's also a study of consciousness. You know, the main way that magic works is like to manipulating plant consciousness, and it's very clear they're manipulating plant consciousness. They're not just like manipulating plants and somehow the plants just intersect with each other and there's a layer underneath that. It says, you know, so for me, incorporating scientists into that again happened, I think this question is interesting because it's not like I went about saying, oh, I want to incorporate scientists into that. I went about saying, what is, you know, what are some questions about this world that I'm curious about that intrigue me? And what are these extremely smart, brilliant people? Like, what are they going to be thinking? The questions that they're going to be answering or asking and exploring. So it was that pursuit of questions and knowledge, really, in many ways, that defined a lot of these characters. Ahilya is an archaeologist. You know, she's looking for a way to survive on this murderous planet. Iravan is studying consciousness, you know, himself, which is like one of the best things to study. And, you know, it defines so many parts of our world, understanding of who we are, you know, cool things like that. The engineer characters are studying, like, you know, how they can make their world function better with the technology that they have and the resources they have. But none of it came from me saying, like, I want to put science into the world. Like, that's not where it came from. It came from, like, what is cool and what is curious. And science is nothing but, you know, a set of replicable, observable behaviors that, you know, make sense and they have logic to them. And, you know, you apply the same pressures and the same result and consequence will happen. And that logic of it is very embedded into the world of surviving sky. You do X, Y will happen. And if you do X and Y does not happen, that means the rules of your world are not completely and fully understood. So there's a lot of logic embedded within that. And that, I think, makes the book scientific as opposed to the fact that there are scientists in the world. Like, they have this label being, you know, scientists or engineers or architects or archaeologists. But it's not what they do, it's how they do it that makes them scientists.
And how they do it in the context of the world that they inhabit.
Totally. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, because I do think that the, you know, with the nature-based magic and all those more fantastical elements, I think that the science nature dynamic is really compelling. And I'm also curious if for you, the science elements kind of balance out with the more philosophical sides of the story. Like, can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. The philosophy of the surviving sky comes from Hindu philosophy, really, which can be a little hard to grasp sometimes and can be a little, you know, it can be quite esoteric. It is very esoteric. And I studied the Upanishads and the Vedas, and my education into all of that, I studied the philosophies of yoga, not, you know, yoga is not just standing in a hot room stretching, like, yeah, I always say that.
Like Western perception.
No, right, not Western. No.
Let's do hot yoga and then like go get a smoothie or some shit.
Yeah. go get a salad.
Go get a goji berry smoothie.
So that's not my, you know, background in yoga. So I studied the philosophies of these things, and they're very much like they peel back a lot of the layers of consciousness and things like that. And I was fascinated with the work of Jiddu Krishnamurti, who was a brilliant philosopher. He was actually an atheist, and like I love that. Like if I were to really call myself anything, I would probably call myself atheistic too, because I don't necessarily believe in one great, you know, God power type thing, but I do believe that there is a force. And I don't know whether that makes me agnostic or atheist, but that's beside the point. But like, I guess what I'm trying to say is that a lot of those philosophies came into the world of Surviving Sky, and balancing that philosophy with world building and the internal logic almost happened seamlessly in some ways, because the philosophies are so abstract, they needed to make sense. They needed to add up, right? There needed to be intention behind it and logic behind it and understanding and comprehension. It wasn't just a bunch of hand waving saying, oh, you know, the force is with you, because that's just how it is, you know.
and then like ruin it with something like midichlorians or whatever.
Totally. So it wasn't that's not how the world of the Rages trilogy is designed. It's, you know, as abstract as the philosophies can be, I think they're anchored in logic, and that makes them real to me. So the science kind of, it balanced the philosophy, which I think, like, if you kind of, that's the funny thing about science, right? The more questions you ask, the more questions you ask. After a point, language becomes an incomplete, imperfect tool. Like, it's not a good tool to use to explain a lot of the deep end of philosophies, because at that point, you're questioning, well, what is this label mean? And then that opens a can of worms. You're like, oh, does it mean this? And then does it mean this? So I think the more you kind of delve into a lot of philosophies, you kind of come across that. But it was almost that desire to anchor it and pin it down, which made the world itself have that kind of unique in-world building and the logic and all of that, because I needed to anchor that philosophy into something.
Mm-hmm. That anchor point thing is really key, because you know, even though this is fiction, even though this has elements of fantasy and all this different kind of stuff, to have those anchor points and the logical consistency, readers will unconsciously, they will unconsciously let the narrative pull them along because of those consistencies. It's like if things were disjointed, then it would just be like, well, I don't fucking know. Then they would start to question things themselves.
Well, say it makes it easier to just, what is it? The accepting of.
Just to kind of like lose yourself and the suspension of disbelief and just kind of like rolling into it and everything like that. And it's also kind of cool because it's like what you mentioned about language and how essentially it becomes a lackluster tool for trying to understand these things. I think that's why science is so interesting, because even though it deals with concepts that are so grand and inexplicable, they have languages like mathematics to keep it grounded in a logical consistency in order to be like, okay, we're not going to just fucking lose ourselves in the madness of quantum theory or the madness of black holes or what have you. Mathematics kind of grounds things and allows it to exist in such a way where we're like, okay, our brains can make sense of this and we can not get lost.
Kind of wrap our arms around it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so for you to have those kinds of tools with the science elements, but intertwined with the philosophy and notions of consciousness and things like that, what awesome stuff did those elements bring to the characters and the plot of your book? And you know, I imagine there were times where you're like surprised by something that happened because of the groundwork that you laid out with these different elements.
I mean, the entire ending of the book is a huge surprise, I have to say. Like, for me, like when I kind of started writing, I'm like, wow, this is where it's heading. And you know, I mentioned previously, like, I am actually very much of a planner. So it's not like it came as a massive surprise. I knew that was an idea I was kind of toying with. But the way it kind of manifested itself is very much, you know, everything kind of seemed like it was aimed towards that, which is, and you know, which is a huge pivotal point in the book and in the series itself. So the book ends, and you know, the revelations that occur at that time. Adrian, can you repeat that question? Just the first part of it about
Just about the way that the foundations that you laid out with the science, with the with the philosophy and all that kind of stuff and the world building, what were some awesome things that brought to the characters and plot of the book?
Well, this is an interesting question. This is a bit of a thinker, because like it feels like it was so long ago. And if there were any surprises, and I'm sure there were many, like I kind of folded them within the mechanics of the book itself, or at least they folded themselves, that it's kind of hard to think back and say, well, you know, this ended up being a surprise. But I think for me, Eravan's journey is really fascinating to me, because at the end of the day, he's kind of asking that question of who am I? And because he is, you know, an architect an academic in many ways, who studying consciousness, for him, that answer is not as easy as saying, I am, you know, this powerful architect, or I'm a husband and this and that. You know, it's like those, for Eravan, a lot of the times those are just labels, because he's trying to peel beneath the surface, and he's like, well, what does this mean? Like, what is this I? Like, what can I rely on? Here's me, and I'm making decisions that affect my life and the people around me and, you know, the world in many ways and my society, but like, I don't know what is influencing me. And a lot of his questions kind of come from that. So that wasn't as much of a surprise as it was in ways that it manifested itself, you know, within the book. And like, I can't tell you because it's going to be a bit of a spoiler, but the way that connected, I think was, it answers a huge plot question. But I think that was, for me, one of like the most rewarding experiences of plotting this world, how it all kind of came together. It was planned, but again, it still in many ways happened organically. It's like, you know, even when you're planning, you kind of like daydreaming, really. That's what planning is. And then you're trying to see like what fits, right? Really, except that you don't do it maybe on paper, you just do it like, you know, on an Excel sheet or whatever. It's like, I don't use Excel. I've heard MJ. Some mad people like MJ, you know, Drew.
Judgment.
Yeah.
Never used Excel in my life. I don't know what you're talking about.
What the fuck are you talking
about? Who uses Excel for writing? So, Yeah, but that's really your planning is it's instead of writing the words on, you know, as a fair document, you're just kind of dreaming and you're pantsing your way until there's a plan. So that's one of the things that came about from there.
Mm-hmm. But that was one of the coolest things about the book for me was Iravan's journey into not just his own consciousness, but notions of consciousness and understanding like what is truth in terms of what nature reveals to you versus what society tells you. And I thought that kind of duality was really interesting to be like, you know, what is the dark side of consciousness versus what is the side that society deems controllable and easier to manipulate and basically instill values upon to the point where people aren't willing to go down paths that might be deemed too experimental or what have you. So that for me was like one of the coolest aspects of the book as well.
And I think like the way that the book also comes together, and this is very much the case in book two and in book three, like there are elements of the prose which kind of come together the way they are kind of depicted in the book and the way that I wrote them is very much like, how do I depict this like piece of maybe broken consciousness or whatever, you know, like how it's going to be represented in the book. So a lot of the prose decisions also came almost because of trying to balance the philosophies with, you know, the science, etc., because it's not just straight up saying, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 or A plus B, you know, if X, then Y. Like it, you know, it wasn't really like that because philosophy itself can be so weird and murky and almost poetic in some ways, which, you know, leaves itself open to interpretation. So a lot of the prose choices that I made in the book were also very much designed around being open to interpretation. And Ahilya and Iravan's entire journey as a married couple is very much open to interpretation, right? Like in at its very base form. And I genuinely do consider that this is one of the base, you know, when I say base, I don't mean it like in any kind of negative way. I just mean like that's the first level of interpretation, you know, is that Ahilya and Iravan, they are very two different people who, when you get behind the head of one, you see things from one person's perspective, and you get behind the head of the other one, you see it from their perspective. But you kind of peel that back. It's more layered than just seeing it from one person and the other person's perspective. It's very much a conversation between the subjective and the objective. It is, as you were saying, about like the kind of choices the narrative itself made. So the prose and the choice of words, etc., the way that is represented, that's another layer of that too. So there's a lot of like weird shit in this book which I've kind of embedded, like some of it deliberately, some of it organically, which kind of came together in this like really lovely way, I think.
And marriage be complicated, man.
Yeah, all right. So I want to dive into the world building, how it coincides with the hard science, because I originally was going to ask what were some of the biggest challenges of including hard science with your fantasy world and story. And, you know, obviously we could still explore that, but I feel like it sounds like it helped you solidify the world building elements, having those hard science rules intersecting with those wildly fantastical, elements of the world. So I'm curious, do you think that it actually made it, was it helpful more so? Because I was viewing it as like, oh my God, how in the heck would you have balanced all of this together? But it sounds like maybe it was helpful for the framework. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the world building is so rock solid. What are your thoughts on that?
Your question cut out there a little bit, but let me see if I've gotten this right. So I think what you're asking is like the rules of, you know, the world, the fact that they are based on so much like science and, you know, logic and all of that, if that kind of made the writing of it and writing philosophy of it robust, is that kind of
yeah, like did it help you keep your world building elements in check, I guess, if that makes sense, keep it from floating too far totally. Into plot hole land?
No, totally. I think it did. because as abstract as some of the world building can be, and as you know, I think we talked about this earlier, but you know, it's very much anchored into, you know, application and logic, which can be followed and is repeatable and is understandable and comprehensible, no matter who is looking at that logic, right? Like, it doesn't matter if an architect or an archaeologist, et cetera, if you're looking at it, that logic stays the same. So for me, yeah, it did help define, because there is so much world building in this, like there are so many different things happening. And it's even the definitions that we use in our ordinary day-to-day language, like an architect is not something, you know, similar in our world as it is in the world of Surviving Sky. An archaeologist is different. An engineer is different.
What's a sungeneer?
Yeah, what the heck is a sungeneer on top of that, right? So I've used these like words, which obviously we have and they exist in our world, but they mean slightly different things in the world of the Rages trilogy. And similar to that, like there are anchor points within the magic system, et cetera, which did help me not go down certain plot holes, et cetera. I don't think it's necessarily that they helped me not go down different like plot holes and different narrative choices. I think what happened is that they allowed me to make my narrative choices intentional. And I think that is key to how I build, you know, the world of the Rages trilogy. It's not that those, you know, and as you're read, you know, when you read it, you'll see that the knowledge that these people think they have is not necessarily full and complete knowledge, and it's challenged, and it's, you know, again, they're like, this has been the wisdom for so long, and then something happens, like quite early in the book, and they're like, wait a minute, you know, and the entire, in many ways, entire plot of Ahilya and Aravind's, one of their mystery plots is to figure out what is going on that is breaking this magic. Right? Like, what is this weird shit that's happening that we have not experienced ever? And why is it happening right now? But in order to answer those questions, there needs to be a foundational understanding of what did exist in the first place. And so I break rules in The Surviving Sky in more than one way, right? Like, even in within the magical world itself, like, rules are broken. But those rules first need to be established, and they need to be strong because they've endured. Like, they're not just like hand waving prophecy rules, like, you know, and so it shall be. Like, no, those are not the rules in the world of Surviving Sky. It's like these have been tested and repeated, and they've survived like thousands of years. So if there is something happening which is breaking them, then that is, you know, A, alarming. But B indicates that there is a gap in knowledge which so far has not been experienced or explored. So it helped me, I think, yeah, really understand the world and build that foundation and the lore and, you know, and even decide which plot elements needed to be explored and which were going to be dead ends or which were not in the scope of this book, right?
Right.
Like maybe that's a different book. So
yeah. And speaking of rules being broken, I feel like it's really cool to hear you talk about the rules that you're establishing. Cause obviously, like, as writers, we understand, like, we have to establish internal rules within the context of the worlds that we create. But it's interesting to bring science into it because, you know, science has its own rules that have endured for a long time. Obviously they shift over time as new knowledge accrues, but when writing science and fantasy, does the science, do you feel like, obviously, in your world, it's like you've taken notes from real world science, but you've applied it to your world in such a way where you can manipulate it to fit what you need to do. But do you feel like there has to be roots in real world science, or that it's more interesting or fun to bend it to the will of a fantasy environment? And you know, breaking the rules of physics because it feels right for your world, like, you know, earth rages and floating cities that don't really feel like, that obviously aren't real within the context of our own world, but within your world, it's like everything makes sense. So what do you feel about that dichotomy between like incorporating aspects of real world science but bending it into a fantasy fold?
I love this question, but I will admit that some parts of it again kind of went out, in and out, because I don't know what's going on with this connection. But you know, we did talk about this question earlier, so I think I have the question that you're kind of asking about, like, can we break certain rules, real world rules such as physics, etc., and still have them be real in the magic system in the world that we kind of create, and still have it be science?
Exactly.
I think that's so interesting because, I mean, physics is physics, maths is maths. I'm not going to argue with that, right? But there are many other kinds of sciences, social sciences as well. And, you know, when we're saying, like, if we're just talking about hard math type, you know, physical sciences, formulas, etc. I cannot but help think of this question in relation to how prevalent Western science has become and how that was not always the case. You know, Western science in the history of science, etc., is still relatively new. This book is based on Hindu philosophy, which has been around for 4,000 years. While, you know, in the West, people were still arguing about the earth being the center of the universe and, you know, the solar system, etc. Mm-hmm. Indian and Hindu astronomers and even like Islamic astronomers, etc., knew that there were, you know, at least back in the day, like
we're
nine
creating,
planets.
Creating calculus
etc. The concept of zero, which is such an important mathematical concept, came from India. Right? So infinity, zero, all of these concepts very much like, you know, they're embedded within many, many, many cultures. So when you kind of think about science and you're like, well, is fantasy kind of building off of, you know, are you breaking certain rules? Are you, you know, using certain rules, etc. of science? I'm just like, well, first of all, which science, right? Like, which form of science are we talking about? And second of all, if we are saying, okay, you know, we're going to legitimize, like I hate saying it like that, but you know, if we're all going to be like, yeah, let's make sure that we include like other sciences and not just Western science. So, you know, even if we're doing that, then I think in many ways to think of it again, as I said, thinking of it as logic and repeatable and observable phenomena, I think is a very, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of science it is, I think. Like, if it is repeatable, it is observable, it is, you know, it can be tested, and no matter who is doing those experiments, etc., if it gives you the same result or consequence, that to me is science, you know, and it doesn't matter the form and nature of it. So in the world of Surviving Sky, as I said, like, I've embedded a lot of Hindu philosophy, etc. So for me, that was the science that I based a lot of stuff on. Like, somebody not coming from that culture or not familiar with any of that would be like, oh my God, this is such cool shit, which is so esoteric and like, I never heard of this. And I don't mean this to be disparaging, and it's coming across like that. Like, everybody can't know everything. That's not what this, you know, that's not what this answer is about. But the point is that somebody who is not aware that there is more than Western science in the world might come to it thinking that this is super new and, you know, very, that Western science is being interpreted in this new way. I think that might be an interpretation that somebody coming into this book in this world, you know, without that kind of awareness, you know, might mistake it for that. But I think somebody else, you know, who has that awareness that more than Western science kind of exists might see inklings of that in the book and be like, this is not just a reinterpretation of Western science, right? And just like The Surviving Sky is not just a reinterpretation of The Wheel of Time or Brandon Sanderson or any of the other things. It's not. It's very much its own thing. Like, these things existed before, way before. And if anything, it is a nod to that, which is why I'm very, like, clear when I'm kind of talking about the book that it is based on Hindu philosophy, so that if anyone is curious about it, like, go look it up, you know?
Yeah,
so,
I mean, that's the hope, is that they wouldn't just kind of put it on this blanket term of like, this is a reinterpretation of Western science or what have you. It's like, no, open your mind to other possibilities, because science is part of global history. It's not just part of Western history. And
the white man didn't come and educate that is not what happened. So
yeah, like, even for me being in South America, it's like I visited different sites like Incan sites and seeing the ways in which they were able to do incredibly accurate astronomy and astrology and just being able to track the stars, being able to track different, like the motion of the moon, the motion of the sun, all these different kinds of things, to be able to pinpoint like equinoxes and all these different things based on their understanding of celestial movements. And that was their system, but we aren't able to interpret it because we didn't come from that culture. And therefore it's like Spanish conquistadors who came here kind of interpreted it as, you know, barbarians, as, you know, unintelligent people, where it's like, no, it's just their way of living is different from yours. And so it's really cool to have the Surviving Sky introduce concepts of science and philosophy that come from a culture that not a lot of, obviously a lot of people are Hindi. So there are a lot of people in India, but coming from a Western perspective, a lot of people might not be familiar with these concepts. So it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And so obviously, you know, the conscious or perhaps just, you know, the natural decision as the story poured out of you to kind of lean away from, you know, leaning on those Western science perspectives. But I'm curious if there were any other science tropes, stereotypes, things that you either wanted to avoid or that you really wanted, you knew you wanted to play with when you knew you were incorporating science into the story?
So, I mean, there were some things that I definitely wanted to avoid, which is like one of the things was, you know, the big bad, you know, big scientific experiment goes wrong and, you know, people have to kind of deal with it and or the trope of, and I'm not going to say it correctly, but, you know, the mad scientist who's just like, you know, I'm just going to do this because I can and, you know, fuck the world, you know? So,
ego trip,
et cetera. Or, you know, just wanting it for the power, et cetera. Not that any of those things are very, very deliberately, you know, even a part of Surviving Sky, but I think the way that the characters really work, and I was very clear and conscious about this, is this is a group of people and a group of characters who are genuinely trying to do the best for their world and, you know, for different parts of society, et cetera, with the information that they've been given and the knowledge that they have and the resources that, you know, they are surrounded with. So while, like, while several characters in this book, many characters in this book have a lot of pride and arrogance and all of those things, when it comes to doing their job, they do their job. Like, they show up and they are fucking competent people, right? So, I really, really wanted to retain that. And I think that is a hallmark of a lot of, basically all of the kind of writing that I write is very much, it is hyper-competent people who are fucking amazing at their jobs, you know, get into a lot of shit, you know, and often not because they don't know their jobs and they don't respect the things that, you know, they're surrounded with, but often sometimes because they don't know as much as they might need to know. And no matter how competent, et cetera, they are, there are limits to their own knowledge. And one of the things, again, that I really wanted to showcase in this book is curiosity. You know, we've talked about this earlier, is that there are no end of questions and, you know, question forms, statements and things like that, ideas. Like, if anything, I would call Surviving Sky in the Ages trilogy a book of ideas, because there are so many packed into this trilogy, into especially into this world, like many, many different philosophies and ideas that intersect, like not just consciousness and rebirth and, you know, things like that we've kind of touched upon, but even agency and, you know, the choice of death, you know, who gets to choose whether or not a person lives or dies, even if that life is your own, and what, you know, what answers and allegiances do you owe to the people around you, right? Like, it delves into things of like mercy killing, but also, you know, looking at certain things like disabilities, etc., in some ways. Like, that's all of that is kind of packed into Surviving Sky, I think, in a really, like, In a way that doesn't like bring attention to it, but if you kind of read it, I think it could make you think about certain things. So I don't know if there were like scientific tropes or stereotypes that I wanted to avoid or kind of lead into, and kind of, but I think I was kind of looking at it from a perspective that intelligent people who are good at heart will try to do intelligent things that are well intentioned, and whether or not that goes well or goes badly, that is the book, right? Like, that's where the conflict comes from. But at the heart of it, these are good people. And I love that also about some of the other books that I, you know, adore. Like Murderbot does this so well, right? Yeah. Like in Murderbot, yeah. you don't have like a big bad except, I mean, sure you do, but it's a Corporation Rim, but you know, you, but the people, the protagonists, et cetera, are all good people. And mm-hmm. I think well-intentioned, yeah. good people, you know? And I think that I really enjoy reading stories like that because I think that provides for more rich, you know, conflict and more rich discussion and nuanced discussion of how right is not necessarily, you know, black and white. And right. it's not.
Yeah, I love that. Complexity is always better. And yeah, I think subtlety is also something that you did particularly well in The Surviving Sky. Because you mentioned like the disability thing and I was just like, yeah, shit. It's just like, you know, the magic, the plant-based magic and the way it works with the city and the city being a living, breathing kind of thing, they're able to adapt the city to be like, there's a wheelchair ramp, you know? Whereas like, I'm thinking about our real life society and I'm just like, just disappointed, man, you know? And it's like, I live like living in South America. I'm like, it's not even a fucking sidewalk here. Like, what is this business? It's like, get it together. So city planning, we just need plant-based magic to make city planning adaptable on the fly.
Let's go. Let's make it happen, guys. Let's do it. Let's
make it happen. It's going to be so good for the environment too.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it would be.
Yeah. Krithika, do you have a final piece of writing advice for authors looking to balance fantastical elements with realistic science? You've already given a ton of really, really good advice, but if you can toss one more out there.
We're greedy. We want more.
When you're building fantastical elements, I will say lead with what is awesome and, you know, what makes for good, like, descriptions and, you know, if that's a kind of world, etc. you're building, what makes for great action scenes, the cinematography, and I would lean your fantastical elements into something like that, you know, which is, but if, and then when you're kind of simultaneously thinking of the science basis of it, then I would build, you know, it's kind of like you look at the iceberg, right? So the tip of the iceberg and the top part of the iceberg should be your fantasy, I would say, you know, from Jesus is the way I'm only articulating it like this right now, but that's, I think, how I think about it, is all the stuff that people will see should be very much, you know, fantasy based, the coolness, the awesomeness. But all the stuff that they don't see, which is what your book is based on, and all the logic, et cetera, that makes its way through your sentence structure, the, you know, the way your plot moves and things like that, I think base that in scientific principles. And again, when I say principles, I mean consistency, observable, all of that, right? Because then that the fantasy elements will float really well and be very, very solid because they are based on the foundation of science. And that science will trickle up from like the iceberg and make itself apparent in many ways so that people will come to you and say, man, this world building is so real and so cool and it's so unique and I've never read anything like this, but it's also, you know, so immersive, et cetera. How'd you do it? And you're like, well, I based it on scientific principles, whatever they mean for your world, really.
Excellent.
That's beautiful. Yeah. And that's a great, very like actionable way to think about it, right?
Where it's are you satisfied, helpful. MJ? greedy
satisfied. I'm satisfied. I like to get all of the advice I can. I literally, I've talked about this before, when we're interviewing people, I legitimately have a notepad and I have a pen. I'm taking notes as we're, because yeah. I'm learning so much. Yeah. So I want to close out with something fun for the listeners and for us. Just some rapid fire recommendations for like fantasy books, shows, movies, video games, whatever you have that incorporate science as an element. So Adrian, kick us off. What you got?
This is one that I've loved for a long time because this is actually the first book that I can distinctly remember the more fantasy-ish book that incorporates a lot of science and scientists, which is A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle. And that book is just so cool because it's like the dad is a scientist and it's just dealing with crazy concepts of space time and wormholes and traveling across the galaxy and everything like that. But at the same time, it's like the planets they visit are so fantastical and the things that they do are so rooted in fantasy that for me, it just feels like the perfect blend of science and fantasy. And this is another one that MJ, I know you love. as well, which is Arcane, the TV show, the animated show, which that is fantastic. That, it was really funny when Kritika mentioned the whole thing about like experiment gone wrong. And I was just like, ha ha ha, hex, heck. But they do it super well. They do a very good job of balancing.
Well, and it comes back to what Kritika said about that they're well-intentioned people, right? So they, you know, they went into it. So it's the same. Yeah, it worked out.
And then my last one is The Dandelion Dynasty by Ken Liu, which is a fantastic series. Very, very much rooted in fantasy, but he kind of like brings out this like silk punk aesthetic, which is amazing. But they have so much cool technology in terms of like the flying vehicles that they have, the way that they use tech to outsmart their enemies. It would be like, you know, to see like siege warfare or like even like kind of mechanical dragons and creatures come into play later on in the series, and it's just fantastic. And he's such a smart writer where he, like you, Kritika, really embeds the science in the fantastical elements, but has that logical consistency where everything feels natural within the framework of the world, and just seeing how the characters utilize all of that is just brilliant.
That sounds amazing. Like, I want to read it now.
Yeah.
Right? I know. I was going to say it's been on my list, and now it's further up my list. Yeah. Yeah. I'll just go really quick with two of mine, because they're super obvious, but I like them. Okay. So the first one is a childhood favorite of mine, Artemis Fowl books. I don't know if you guys read them. Yeah. Because, yeah, yeah. Like, you know, of course, there's elves and fairies and all this stuff, and gnomes and stuff. But these creatures that live in this underground society, they have all this science and they're, you know, companies, and they build stuff. And like, when I was playing with my cousins, we were pretending that we were in Artemis Fowl. We weren't pretending that we were fairies or whatever necessarily. Oh my God, such a nerd forever. But we were pretending like we had those, what were they? The hummingbird little jetpacks. You know what I mean? We were really loving those little sciencey elements that were in there. And then the second one is Star Wars. Like, it is, it's like the classic, I mean, not the classic, a classic example though, right? Where it's like, it's a space opera, but the Force, right? And then there's just these, you know, Jedi wizards that appear, and they do, it is hand wavy shit. It is much less hard science-y, right? But it is, I think it's, you know, it's a fun one. What about you, Kritika? What do you have for some rapid fire recs?
Oh, wow. Okay, so I have a few. So my first one is Foundryside, which I know, Adrian, you referenced earlier as well. So, and Foundryside is
so good.
Very much a science fantasy thing. The logic of it, it's actually, like, I love that book because it's
coding. Cyberpunk. Coding is magic.
Yeah, it's coding. It's coding is magic. It's amazing. But it's also, like, epic fantasy in some ways, right? Like, it's beautifully done. And it has this heist thing going on, which I'm just like, oh my God, catnip. Like, everything about that book and that series. I love the
fantasy. Everything we love.
So that's one of mine. The second one is, I mean, this might be a bit of a weird pick, but Avatar The Last Airbender, you know? And the Korra as well.
Korra definitely plays into that.
Yeah, because there's all of the elemental magic and the fire bending and the earth bending and all of that. But then there's such a big tech piece of it. Like, Sokka's entire storyline is being the science guy, right? Like, that's what Sokka is in. So that's one. And then I'm going to shout out Essa Hansen as well. Like, her Graven trilogy, Norfolk Gloss being the first of the book, is, again, it's marketed as science fiction, but I actually think it's sound fantasy because it has all of these cool consciousness memory type things in there, you know, all these amazing ideas, which are very science-based, but also the plotting and the world, etc., is, you know, in some ways it follows, like, the journey of this young boy in a very Star Wars-like fashion, which is, again, like, science fantasy, as you kind of mentioned. So, I mean, there are so many, but, like, these are ones that have kind of stayed with me. And at least Avatar, I know, is often not thought about as science fantasy, but in my head, MCU is another big one, really. You know, you have Thor, but you have Cap, you have Iron Man as well, who's, like, really a scientist. And, those are some big ones, I guess.
Great picks. I'm just going to toss out two more real quick. His Dark Materials series by Philip Pullman.
Oh, yeah.
Really good. But also, you brought up Essa Hansen's series, which is fantastic, but also Ada Hoffman's The Outside, which plays a lot with this concept of consciousness and has scientist main characters and is really, really cool and trippy and kind of plays into these like cosmic horror elements as well, which is like really, really cool. But it's, yeah, it's fantastic. And I highly recommend that as well. But yeah, some great picks. Avatar is definitely a science fantasy. And I love that.
I never thought of that until you just said that. But I'm like, holy shit, you're right.
And especially
when you think about Korra. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When it gets into Korra, she's like, yeah, they're driving cars and shit. And it's like,
yeah, exactly. 100%.
I love it.
It's a steampunk world, right?
It's steampunk. Yeah. Yeah, awesome. Well, that is it for this mini masterclass and our two-parter with Krithika. Thank you again for taking the time to chat with us and imparting so much awesome knowledge about science and fantasy and the melding of these beautiful, beautiful things. I hope people listen to this and take away the malleable nature of genre and not feeling like you talked about last episode. It's like, be weird, be you, you know, write what you love. And if you feel like what you want to write doesn't box you into like the right marketable genre or anything like that, it's just like, fuck it, just do your thing,
right? And do what you love.
Yeah, yeah, people will love it. So yeah, thank you again for hanging out with us, Krithika. It's been an absolute
thank you so much
blast.
For having me. This was a blast. Yeah, yeah, so much fun. Thanks so much.
And as well, for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more a month, there will be a reading by Krithika from The Surviving Sky, so you can go check that out and hear chapter one of the book. Krithika, where can people find you on social media?
I am at Krithika H. Rao on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. If you really want to contact me, get to me through my website. There's a contact form, and I'm usually also.
Awesome. And The Surviving Sky is out on June 13th, so that will already be out by the time these episodes are released. So highly recommend you go pick up the book, support Krithika, and enjoy a really, really awesome story. It's gonna pull you along and just fill you with all kinds of frustration and happiness.
Yeah, I was saying, and just feelings in general.
Yeah, feelings.
All
you
of
you
that.
Have feelings.
Yeah, it's basically like an earth rage of feelings, and it's a really
there we
time.
Go.
So, yeah.
See, that's a tagline.
That's my
that.
Blurb for you. An earth rage of emotion.
Oh, I love it. It's perfect. I'm gonna send that to Titan Books and say from SFF podcast.
Yeah, yeah, right. Earth rage of emotions. Awesome. And you can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram and Twitter at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, where can people find you?
Yeah, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. I am at MJ Kuhn Books.
Fantastic. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.